Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Whiskey Neat, spirited conversations with interesting people. I am your host, Christopher Hart. Man, boy, this week was something else. First in-studio guest in a couple of months, it feels like, Mark Schilling from Big Thirst Marketing, the CEO of Susto Mezcal. We do a lot of shit-talking this episode, right? We talk about, God, so much. But to be clear, we're two people having a conversation about this industry. We're friends. This conversations we would have without the camera. A lot of it was not actually shit talking. It was more of just, you know, kind of revealing how I feel about some things. So Mark is a longtime friend. He's the CEO of Susto Mezcal. We talk mezcal. We talk the abomination that is the agave industry in America, and how I feel some people take advantage of Mexican producers, and that it's the one thing that's not talked about enough, which we have covered on the show before. Of course, I put Gregarious Grump in front of Mark, which, by the way, guys, Gregarious Grump is now available online through Sealbox, SEELBACHS, sealbox.com. Google Gregarious Grump Sealbox. We've got our cognacs up there, the 10-year, the 12-year, the 14-year, and the 30-year, which I think they just sold out of. And, of course, Prideful Goat, all available on Sealbox. We've got more coming, more things to come. The 7th annual Houston Whiskey Social tickets just went on sale last night at midnight. We are what I can only assume millions and millions of dollars into ticket sales in the last 6 hours. And you can get your tickets at HoustonWhiskeySocial.com. Go to Eventbrite, look up The Whiskey Social, Google the 7th annual Whiskey Social. Go to Facebook. We've got The Houston Whiskey Social 7th annual event online. Get your tickets. The Pappy and BTAC tickets are definitely gone, but we've got tens of thousands of dollars of vintage whiskey that we're going to be featuring. We're going to be expecting somewhere between 1,800 and 2,000 guests. We have all the plans in the world for our 7th annual event. I could not be more excited. HoustonWhiskeySocial.com, whiskey with the E. Get your tickets today. Consider this us paying the bills. I'm not doing an ad read today, but we start off with Waterford. If there's anyone I know in this industry for almost a decade that is nerdy about terroir, about origin, about the development, about production, about marketing, every aspect of what it takes to produce a spirit, it's Mark Schilling over at Big Thirst Marketing and Big Thirst Consulting. Mark has been a good friend of mine. He's a legal expert in the stupid laws in this stupid state, and has consulted with distilleries across the state in developing products. It's the reason he's just become CEO of Susto Mezcal. He's just a good friend of mine. So we catch up. We talk about everything he's working on. We talk about everything I'm working on, me leaving Gulf Coast Distillers, the development of Giant Texas Distillers. It's just an episode for me to catch up with a good friend and what he's doing. So without further ado, please welcome my good friend from Big Thirst Consulting, Big Thirst Marketing, Susto Mezcal, Mark Schilling. The man with better hair than I could ever hope to have, especially at his age. Jesus Christ, he's got a good head of hair. Mark Schilling, cheers. This is the Luna 1.1. Do you know much about that brand?
I don't. I know a little bit about the terroir study and whatnot, which I'm really into. I'm one of the people that believes there is terroir.
I have evolved my opinion over time. Essentially, I think that the higher the distillation proof, the lower the influence of terroir.
That makes a lot of sense.
Of course it does. I said it, and I'm always correct. but I had the discussion with Mike from Reserve 101. He says it's bullshit, that the six regions of Scotland is bullshit. And it largely is, because a lot of them order barley from all over. The subject of terroir doesn't really play right into their processes. Scotch is also distilled at super high proofs. And what they have is signature aspects, regional signature aspects. Mm-hmm. In the same way that enchiladas or tacos from here are going to taste right different than from, you know, San Antonio. Mm-hmm. So then I had Mike in, and Mike brings me these great examples of mezcal and sotol, mm-hmm. where they're the only difference is the variety of plant. And two examples. So the equipment, the exact same equipment. The mezcalero or sotolero was the exact same cooker. Mm-hmm. The parameters of the cooking process were the exact same. The only difference was the variety, mm-hmm. or where the plant grew.
Right.
So he actually showed me examples. Do you have something you want to say?
No. I was just going to adjust. Yeah. Keep going.
Yeah. So he actually showed me examples of same distillation proof, same mm-hmm. same cooker, same chef. And then I was like, yeah, I could tell the difference. Like, it's clearly a thing. And distillation proof on those items are very low. So you're going to get all the plant influence and no wood influence, which would also fuck up the idea of terroir if you have oak. Oak's going to overpower the distillate.
That doesn't mean it's not there. It just means you and I and, you know, maybe even somebody with one of those super palates. Maybe you're not going to be able to detect it. It doesn't mean it's not there.
Sure.
But agave and sotol are really, really great examples of this because if you think about it, those plants have been sitting in the same place and growing in some cases for decades, right? Whereas with whiskey, corn, wheat, rye, malt, whatever it is.
It's a season.
One season worth of terroir, worth of existence, worth of experience, right? Whereas an agave might sit in the same place and experience weather and other conditions, other plants growing nearby it,
sure,
off and on for 8, 10, 12, 25 years. So there's a lot more time for a lot of interesting things to happen. And that same plant that is growing up at the top of the hill versus the bottom of the hill, same as the experience of a barrel in a rickhouse, right? They're going to have different experiences.
Yeah, so I definitely am on the path of the understanding that the difference of terroir is a real thing. Waterford has been pushing mm-hmm. for that. So they actually put who grew it, like on the back mm-hmm. of the bottle it actually says. The growers were Trevor Harris, John McDonald, and Alan Mooney. It tells you the farm.
Mm-hmm.
It tells you the grain. I mean, it tells you so much information that they can't fit on the bottle or the box that they actually put in a terroir code that you can mm-hmm. go online and look it up, kind of like how Scotch Malt Whiskey Society puts the codes mm-hmm. and you can kind of see what distillery it came from. Yeah. It's a really interesting aspect. I'd love to see, and they're doing a lot of different things. I know they're doing some wine finishes. I'd love to see a cask strength option.
Mm-hmm.
Just the whiskey high proof nerd in me. I want to taste more. So I normally start with this. It's 100 proofer. Right after I have my sugar free monster.
Mm-hmm.
And then I actually brought a few things. I know that there's so much I want to talk about. First of all, welcome to the show. Welcome back.
Thank you.
It's been a couple years. Mark and I are good friends. Mark Schilling of Big Thirst Marketing, of Big Thirst Consulting, and now your new title at Susto Mezcal is?
Chief Executive Officer, which is really a
Jesus.
It's a fancy way of saying in a very small company, you know, the guy that's responsible for everything that gets fucked up mm-hmm. along the way.
Yeah so it's all on you. You're to blame.
Yeah.
How long have you, I know it's about a month?
Sometime in February is okay. when it became official. And so Susto was a client of Big Thirst Consulting for a little while. And throughout that period of time, kind of that relationship grew. The company is relatively new, very small. Other than me, technically speaking, I guess you would say two employees. I would not count Crispin, our mezcalero. He's actually a partner in the company, so I don't consider him an employee.
Sure.
So it's really a matter of a small company growing to the degree that the founders of the company, who all have day jobs and other things, really needed somebody to be able to come in and run the day-to-day operations.
Yeah, so we have a rule. A couple years ago, we kind of shifted. We don't do brand interviews anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Any person who would do a podcast or a show has done a bunch of them, and it's usually the same spiel.
Mm-hmm.
However, The exception to this rule is we're friends. I've known you a long time. And there's so much more I want to talk to you beyond the brand. And I am obsessed with Mezcal and Sotol. It's one of my dreams. It's a weird climate for this sort of thing. But I've always wanted to do like a small batch for Gregarious.
Yeah.
But to do it in a way that features the producer, and I'm more of a footnote. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's in the similar packaging. The logo's there. Like, you know it's my product. But it's not about me, and I'm not going to bastardize mm-hmm. it with anything. You know, even then, I think we're still a little ways away from it. We released a cognac. We released five cognacs this year. And the... there were a few people in the brandy world who were very nervous about the bourbon guy doing, what are you going to do to our brandy? Like, well, I'm not going to do anything to it. We're not going to do any bourbon finishing. We're not going to do anything crazy. I wanted to find good liquid that I love and just feature it. Just feature the liquid. Put as much information as the producer will let me put on there, which honestly isn't much for the cognacs because we imported it directly, avoiding a lot of taxes and because mm-hmm. it's an American product technically. So we avoided tariffs and taxes on finished goods from other countries and bottled it here, produced it here. So we were asked not to disclose the producer because our products are actually cheaper than what the producer's yeah. products are here.
Well, you know, that's interesting if you think about it. If I were one of those producers, I would probably go into it with the same sort of set of concerns that you just expressed they had. But then at the same time, I'm thinking, particularly in this country, in this market, you know, there's a huge amount of room for brandy and cognac and things in that category that I think if you had more people doing interesting things to cognac, or let's say brandy generally, that you have with folks like Beryl and Lost Lantern doing with whiskey,
sure.
I think it would interest it would gain the interest of a lot of
it would grow
people.
The category.
Yeah.
Yeah, the category is so small right now that me sourcing product, which is again, if you source whiskey in America, it's going to be very difficult for that whiskey to be cheaper than the producer's own product on the shelf. It's the exact opposite in this case where cognac specifically at the time was just cheap enough that it, or not cheap, but just as inexpensive. Cheap's a bad marketing word. That's the marketing in me. Speaking of bad marketing on the way here, is there anything more wasteful than a billboard ad for alcohol? I cannot wrap my mind around the waste of thousands of dollars for a goddamn billboard in Houston for your Zen, your Zephyr Gin, or whatever the brand. It seems like such a waste.
I cannot imagine spending that kind of money on a billboard when there are so many for the same amount of money you can get so much more out of almost any other thing you would do.
That's exactly my point. There are so many things that are even sending sample kits to certain influencers will get more of an ROI. And that's the thing, and that's the hard part about marketing, period, is the ROI is hard to prove in marketing,
right.
Except at a high level, like is the brand growing overall for the year? Okay, well then marketing must be working, but there's actually no way to know.
Right.
You know, it's hard to prove. But nothing to me is more of a waste or vain than, mm-hmm. And this is the cynical, and if I know a cynical person in this room, believe it or not, it's Mark and not me. But nothing seems like such a waste of money than a billboard. But I forgot my original point. But it was just cheaper. The cognac
right.
was cheaper. Yeah. So you, Big Thirst Marketing. I've worked with you, Matt, and you know we've worked for the last couple of years. We kind of have been in each other's circles. Obviously, in fact, I think you and Matt are directly responsible for Gulf Coast changing their name to Giant.
I am glad to hear that because we did have a number of conversations with Carlos and a few other folks about the name and the tasting room and some of the things they were doing and some suggestions. And oftentimes when you're having those casual conversations, you never really know if any of that ends up being a part or a factor in a decision later
sure.
on down the road. So.
Well, yeah, a lot of those conversations are flippant. They're just kind of thinking out loud. But I will say that with a fair amount of certainty, that is exactly the case. Mm-hmm. That because we had the discussion, I actually didn't want them to change the name. I agreed with y'all's assessment. Your assessment, and correct me if I'm wrong. This is a while ago, but the assessment was the name is Gulf Coast Distillers, and still is on the DBA paperwork, but that. You're the only one of the only distilleries that I know of off the top of my head that has a product. The main core brand product is not the same name as the distillery. Like Buffalo Trace has Buffalo Trace, Sagamore has Sagamore, Still Austin, Balcones. Which I agreed at the beginning, that should have been the thought. But now you're 8 years in and you've developed a name. People know GCD. I was like, no, just leave it. It's too late now. And I got outvoted, of course, but now it's Giant Texas Distillers, which I think is a great name. It works well. The brand's been reinvented.
I don't know that it was so much a conversation about changing the name of the distillery as it was about promoting the name of the products made by the distillery in a way that made sense.
Sure.
Which at the time, I don't think the tasting room was open. I don't think there was any reference to Giant other than the products at the time. But I may be misremembering.
There was some signage within the room, but not a lot. Yeah. And you know, all the shirts, and then on the side of the distillery, it said Giant. Yeah. But my assessment of the whole thing was just simply that you've been around long enough that you've pushed past this initial bad idea. Like it would have been great to consider this 8 years ago, mm-hmm. and then name it accordingly. But yeah, and I remember thinking like, yeah, Mark and Matt made a great idea, great suggestion. And you made change.
I'm glad to hear it, and I hope it's working out well over there.
Yeah, there's lots of
obviously any change in the middle of a 2 to 3 year global pandemic is going to be hard to quantify after the fact. But
I would disagree in this case. I think the change that has happened has been monumental.
Yeah,
there's been a lot of behind the scenes monumental changes, and the person that's in charge of marketing over there now. Michelle Hunley is incredible. Chief Marketing Officer for Gulf Coast. She's done, and I said this to her face, she's the most resumed person I've ever seen in my entire life. Like, you know those people, I always told myself if I had the money and the time, I would just keep going to school. I would get mm-hmm. a degree in and I've got three, but I would keep going, you know? This woman has a bunch and is a juris doctor in law. She was a prosecutor for years. She's worked in politics, and you have to know marketing if mm-hmm. you work in politics. They could not have found a more qualified person. So, yes, the change has been monumental. But it all, I think, around the same time that I convinced Gulf Coast to relaunch the Giant brand, you guys convinced them mm-hmm. to change the name, and it was a great timing.
Yeah, and I think, if I remember correctly, a part of that conversation revolved around the fact that they have so many products, so many brands, some their own, some not their own, that if you don't know the difference, it's just lost in this big cacophony of different brands, and you don't know what's what, who belongs to what things are related to each other, and all that sort of thing. So.
Yeah, they own quite a bit, for sure, and a big part of a lot of people don't know this, so... I would venture to say that most of the brands on the market, for those listening, here's a little insider information. For most of the brands that exist, they're brands that are not produced at their facility, meaning the brand's own facility. Co-packing is a very profitable side of the business. One of the greatest facilities to be built in the last 8 years was Bardstown Bourbon Company. They bottle for everyone you can possibly imagine. It's usually from a case rate fee of like either $8 a case. I've seen as high as $18 a case. Gulf Coast bottles and produces for a lot of other people. Iron Root, before when we started Gregarious, Iron Root was my bottler. They bottled for me. And they bottle for Nico, who I love, mm-hmm. Nico Martini's brand, Grayson. And then the guys over at Bourbon Real Talk, Someone Say Whiskey, they have their brand there called Unallocated. So it's a very big part of the business. So a lot of people will own the intellectual property of a product. They own the brand itself and will just bottle at a facility for them. And it saves you a lot of SG&A.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
So, all right. So you have taken over as CEO, which is one hell of a title. And you're now producing. I actually found this brand, first time I ever saw it, thanks to Dragon Spirits.
Mm-hmm.
Lamar gave me this bottle.
Really?
Yes. It's still sitting on my shelf.
A while back, before my time, I guess?
Like a month before, like okay. Very recently.
Yeah, interesting.
Lamar was here in town and gave me this bottle. I have not even opened it.
Well, you're about to then.
So I brought old.
However you want to, okay. Whatever order or.
So let's. I feel like this is going to affect our palates greatly. Let's do the old granddad first. Normally okay. We do a special bottle last, but
okay.
You said you were a fan of old granddad?
I am, yeah. It's probably, it's definitely in my top three go-tos. You know, I feel like you always have to have a.
Smells fantastic.
A set of, like, if you go into a bar and you don't want to take the time to think through or, you know, it's hard for me to sit at a bar and not examine and analyze the entire back bar for 30 minutes before I make a choice, right? Old Granddad is so solid.
And I think it goes for a decent $800-$900 a bottle now.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and it was
because
like, and it was
people
like,
are all over it, so.
Yeah, I mean, people go apeshit over this stuff, and back then it was probably $10 a bottle,
yeah.
Something ridiculous.
So, side question, because I know that you have managed to find a relatively large number of these old bottles.
Yeah.
I assume some of it's just from being around and creating a pretty big network, but how much time do you spend on that versus do they just kind of magically appear?
Not much anymore. There are different times of the year that we do. Like for the for those who are watching this, which is this airs tomorrow. Tickets for the Whiskey Social just went on sale as of midnight last night. And what we normally do is we try to feature a bunch of vintage bottles at the event.
Mm-hmm.
The tickets are not tied to the alcohol itself, so we are giving away the booze.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so a couple times a year we'll make some large purchases at auction, and there's monthly auctions and I get notifications for it. So if there's a couple of auction websites that are going up, I'll peruse what's going to go available and kind of plan for it. And then we, like last year, I think we poured and emptied somewhere around $40,000 in Dusties at the event, and just, I mean, it was some crazy number. It was some stupid number. But it was the first event back from COVID. So we had a lot of time to peruse and maybe buy a little too much. But, yeah, it doesn't take a lot of effort now. I mean, it used to. But I hate to say it this way, but, you know, everyone's got their plug.
Mm-hmm.
Where you have your three or four main stores you'll go to. Or, you know, once you know where to get stuff, then you just go back and say, hey, what do you got available? What's going on? But it's good. It's great. Old. I had this great conversation with Jared Hempstead about Coney's. About they outlawed somewhere around 82 to 85. They outlawed the use of horse shit, like manure, in the fermentation process, for obvious reasons. And there's been all this speculation about why Dusty's all have a signature taste, something different about them. Like the you know, like dunder pits, right? Like you get bugs and this or that. And he goes, they at one point in time, there's a lot of this debate over it's like old growth oak or new growth oak or the grains were non-GMO or whatever the case might be. He's like, there's a portion of it where they were using manure during the fermentation process because of all the bacteria. And I don't know the whole ins and outs of it, but he goes, it was around 85, 86 that bourbon changed, and there may have been because of that outlaw.
I didn't know anything about that.
Yeah, you could probably do some research on it and talk to someone like Chuck Cowdery a little bit more. But I want to say it was some of the yeast component during the fermentation process to really kick off the bacterial growth and the conversion starches to sugars was manure. So I was like, oh, that's, I mean, I don't taste manure, but if it is, it's good shit.
It worked.
I don't think we've talked about this on the show, and we kind of mentioned it, but I actually left Gulf Coast Distillers. I'm no longer the director of product development as of a week ago. I specifically left to free up bandwidth. We had intentions of doing an agave social mm-hmm. that never came to fruition. A big part of that was time. We don't have any other staff to help with it. And two, there's a little bit of a language barrier trying to explain what the event is when there's not really anything like it here.
Right.
So it just fell apart. And I filed the trademark, bought the website. So it does need to happen. But we've just had bandwidth issues. And then so to focus on Gregarious and Prideful, we're working on new state distribution. I think we're in 8 states now. Officially 8 states, but technically 40 something if you include our online retailers who shipped, which, by the way, I need to talk to you about something. So one of the things Big Thirst Marketing pioneered was somehow to your door shipping,
sort of.
I don't understand, and people keep saying you need to talk to Big Thirst, because this is, we have a distributor in Canada that wants us,
okay,
called Evergreen Beverage. You need a special permit from FedEx to ship samples to a distributor or to a liquor store, and it has to be someone with a license. Gulf Coast does not have that license, and it's been like 2 months process trying to get approved for it so that we can send our products to customs in Canada to get to the distributor. The only thing stopping us from a multiple country badge of honor is I can't get my bottles to Canada in a timely fashion with FedEx or DHL.
Hmm. And that's because of customs or because of...
Well, I could pack a box that says alcohol on it to FedEx. Mm-hmm. It will not make it to Canada. I have to have permission from FedEx to officially ship alcohol. And so if I give them a package that's labeled alcohol with the custom declarations and stuff right. on it, it's not going to even make it to customs because I'm not authorized to ship with FedEx.
So you just need either through UPS or FedEx Spirit shipping permit. Or when I say permit, I'm internal to the company.
Sure.
And I have one with UPS, and I got to tell you, it was one of the most challenging things I've ever gone through.
It's a nightmare.
And part of it is because I think there are very few people in the company that are even aware that they can ship spirits with the right things in place. So getting to the right person, and then, you know, even on the website, it's because they've done it for years, everything is set up for wine shipping. And spirit shipping is not the same. The rules are not the same. The states are not the same. I don't know much about Canada. I did ship a couple of bottles to the UK some years ago through FedEx, and that was, I kid you not, a 19-hour ordeal just to work through all of the paperwork and bureaucracy to get it done.
Just to ship a non-alcoholic package to the UK, we shipped something to Sam Heughan for the second episode we did, and I had to say it was personal belongings or memorabilia or something, and it still took too long, and it was like $300. It was a nightmare. Mm-hmm. So I guess in short, you're saying if I give these bottles to Big Thirst Marketing, you guys can get them to Canada?
No, I'm not saying that. Right now, we're only shipping in the United States, and to be very clear, we don't do the shipping. We're just the e-commerce portal that manages the transaction. And technically, the transaction happens at the retailer in the location where the bottle's being sold from. And that's what makes it legal.
Which is now, also how we sell products at the social the night of.
Right.
We have a QR code. You can order from your phone. We actually have someone that can take the order there. But it's no different than right. if you were to order something on Total Wine's website now and then go yeah. pick it up in store.
Right. So the difference is with Total Wine or what you're doing, that's delivery, and it's local, so it has to be within the county area, right?
No delivery. You have to go pick it up
well,
in store.
Okay, right. But for like Drizzly and those kind of
yes.
companies,
yeah,
what I'm
yeah.
saying is they only operate within the county. They can't cross county lines. With shipping, it's relatively cross-country, but And we're set up much like most of the other online DTC companies are, in that the product ships from a retailer in a state to a consumer in a state that can legally receive spirits from a retailer in another state.
Right.
So it's not every state. It's not everywhere.
And yeah, we order our products are available online through Bourbon Outfitter and Sealbox.
Okay.
Sealbox can ship to like 20 states legally. Bourbon Outfitters will ship to like 40 states.
Yeah. My experience is most of them will ship almost anywhere.
Sure.
Under the right circumstances. We don't want them to do that.
Right.
Because we want to be legal and
right.
uphold the law. And
hey, you
not
want to be part of some class yeah. action.
I'm all for pushing boundaries and changing laws, but I don't want to be breaking them.
Sure.
Right? So ultimately, that's their decision, and we can't control it. But in our agreements with them, we're very clear that if you're shipping illegally to a state that it's illegal, then you're subject to losing your deal with us. What's great about DC, Sealbox or anybody else, we don't use Sealbox. We use a different retailer there. But as a producer, as a supplier, you don't have to have a distributor to ship product to a retailer in DC.
You get to keep more margin. Right.
More margin. You're going to spend some money on shipping. And it's not really, honestly, it's not as much about the margin as it is about the ease of just being able to get product there
sure.
and get it out. The other thing is with shipping spirits, if it costs $20 to ship a $20 bottle of booze across the country, is it really worth it to the consumer? If it's a $120 bottle, or it's a rare bottle, or something that somebody really, really wants for some reason, they can't get it in their local area, it might make sense to spend that kind of money. But for a lot of bottles, it's just not cost effective. If you add the cost of distribution into that, then it's just another layer of, well, I got bottles online I can sell to people in some states, but they're too expensive for anybody to really spend any time or money on them.
Yeah, so. You actually just reminded me. We advertise that we sell through Sealbox and Bourbon Outfitters, but we don't actually have a portal on our website. It's something that's evolved quite a bit over the last few years, and I think there's been some progress in terms of recognizing the level of stupidity behind it.
Mm-hmm.
You can order as much wine as you want to your door. In fact, we're part of a club, De Negocio or whatever. We'll buy 12 bottles of wine at a time, a case,
mm-hmm.
delivered to our house, no problem. But you can't get a bottle of right. whiskey.
Yeah. And ultimately, my goal is not for just retailers to be able to ship to more people everywhere, but for producers themselves to ship directly,
right.
just like wineries,
right.
just like every other product in the country, with the exception of beer. I think that's correct.
You can't order beer?
I don't think you can ship beer. It may be that you can in some limited circumstances. You can ship cigarettes. You can ship firearms.
Cigars.
Drugs. Prescription drugs.
Sure,
yeah.
sure.
Or other drugs,
yeah,
I
yeah,
suppose.
Yeah. Long There's some places if, that'll ship weed to your house.
Yeah. Olive oil.
Right. Yeah, barbecue sauce.
Yeah,
it is Texas.
Exactly.
All right, so you guys handle the and Matt actually reached out to me whenever we launched with Sealbox and was like, hey, we should discuss. And I had intended to. That's part of the reason all of this to boil down, there's too much on my plate. I need more time to do these things.
Mm-hmm.
So Gregarious Grump, Prideful Goat are still my babies. I'm still going to be focused on these things. But also managing all of the other products for Gulf Coast was just too much.
Yeah.
So I left. We are focusing on new state expansion and new country expansion, and
mm-hmm.
we can figure out that. I'll be going to Chicago next week. We got a thing going on with Sam Morril and Mark Norman. Their whiskey's coming. It's a lot. It's time consuming.
Mm-hmm.
Takes up your whole time. I mean, that's what you're here for. You're actually here in Houston to push Susto.
Yeah. But, you know, I do a lot of other things, too. And not that I have any more time than you, but if and when you get around to Agave Social again, let me know. I'd love to be involved in some way in helping with that.
I want so badly to do it simply because there is, over the last few years, I think some people think of me and HBS as being a bourbon group or a bourbon guy. But I started with Scotch. I love mezcal and sotol. I hate tequila. Hate vodka. But rum, our first products we released were rum. And then cognac. And I mean, there's a world of fantastic spirits out there. And yeah, the Whiskey Social is my baby. The seventh annual event is happening this year. I would love to see some agave. And we can cut the event in half. Like, let's, for our first Agave Social, let's just keep it small. Let's put it around 600 people. That event venue could do, it's almost a third. We could do 600 people, no problem.
Yeah, and I think the education that you could do along with it, there's so much to do. I think it could be really, really well designed.
Are you guys still doing Big Thirst at the same time?
Yes. So Big Thirst is really three different companies that are all related, but structurally separate. There's marketing, consulting, and then the e-commerce company. Most of my time is spent on consulting outside of Susto now, and most of my time within that is really on operational type things. Anything from, you know, I've been managing the expansion project at Milam and Green. I work with a number of distilleries who are in the startup phase, either with their permitting, equipment selection process, product development, things like that. I support Joe on sales and distribution work. That's really his area.
Sure.
He's an expert in that. You know, any of us that have been in this business for some period of time have a lot of exposure to it.
But, sure.
You know, I let him, you know.
And Matt's on the marketing side.
Matt's primarily marketing and then e-commerce. So we kind of each have our little areas. We back each other up. And, you know, part of this was because we all seem to pass each other on different projects around the state. And we've all known each other for a long time. And, you know, at some point early on during the pandemic, we were talking about it. Thought, well, instead of doing this all separately, what if we kind of rolled it into sort of a one-stop turnkey where somebody can come to one place and get whatever it is they need, not pay for stuff they don't need. So everything we do is really custom to what the client wants or
sure.
needs, right? So, you know, and that's what kind of led into the relationship with Susto. And I'm excited about it because it gives me an opportunity to work in a different area of the industry, which is importing, than what I've had experience with before. You know, production of mezcal versus production of bourbon or gin or anything else, obviously there are differences, but it's production. Distribution is distribution. You know, being able to get involved in the ins and outs, the bureaucracy of importing and all of the other things that go along with that is not something a lot of people have the opportunity to do. And
so you guys, so why not? Import, it's based here in Texas?
So the company is divided really into two parts. There's a Mexican company, which is where the production occurs,
right.
in Oaxaca, or actually just southeast of Oaxaca. And then the U.S. company, which is the import company. So what's a little bit different about Susto than most mezcals that you find here is we own the NOM. We're independent. Although we lease the agave fields that we farm the agave from, we own all of the production. Everything's done in-house. There's no white labeling. We do use a...
Can I open it?
Yeah, please. We use a bottler in Oaxaca, but we're actually working right now to sort of map out all of the palenques in San Dionisio Cotepec, which is the area where we're located.
You know, there's an app that will help with that.
Yes, but we actually have an intern from Texas State getting ready to start. She's going to go down there, and she's a GIS and mapping specialist. and we're going to very specifically map them out. And these are mostly small places that don't do any sort of importing and may not even sell outside of their local communities. But our intent is to build a cooperative bottling facility somewhere in the middle of that that's easy for those folks to get to and use, rather than having to go in and use a big, large commercial firm in Oaxaca.
So, yeah, I think you should steer away from that for sure. I was talking to, how do I say this? to be careful here. The current environment of Mexican spirits is an interesting one. How much is this bottle?
Retail, anywhere from probably $39 to $42.
Okay, that is incredibly low priced.
It is, yeah. And for a reason, and that is. Let me be thoughtful about how I say this.
I'm trying.
Well, so Crispin, sure. Who is our mezcalero, who his family has been making mezcal for at least, as far as I know, at least several generations. We're not just buying this from him.
Mm-hmm.
We have made him a full partner in the company. So whereas some companies are just buying and jacking up prices on liquid.
It's not just the jacking up of the prices. They say that nothing sells more than sex except nostalgia.
Right.
There is something traditional and exotic in a lot of Mexican bottles, whether it's tequila, agave, sotol. There's something exotic, and then you've got a collection of tequila on your back bar, and you can see all the different shapes, and none of them are real practical for bars, but because they're so, a skeleton in a sombrero is so exotic, yeah, that you're like, you want to collect them all like Pokemon, you know?
I'm not a fan of the novelty bottles at all.
That's the word I'm looking for.
Yeah.
Novelty.
That being said, I mean, if you look at our bottle, we do have the skeletons, the calacas.
Is very toned down.
No, but yeah, it's... We're not a novelty bottle,
yes,
but the imagery is very similar.
There is a thing that's happening in Mexican spirits right now, specifically threefold. Additives. I was having this great discussion with this guy, David Woolley, who used to work for Sazerac. And we were talking, we were at St. Arnold's Brewery here in Houston, and his specific job is to create these large bulk commodity products that are not very loved, mm-hmm, right? And he's like, we got to come up with a smoky tequila. And I was like, I got this. I work in marketing. I got this. What's the Spanish word for charcoal? And he Googles it, and he's like, oh, tequila carbon. What a great name. And I was like, yeah, you're welcome. That'll be $20,000. Tequila carbon is such, and it's like a smoky tequila flavored, but the name tequila carbon is like, it fits, mm-hmm, like it's perfect for
right.
this. Specifically in Mexican spirits, bottle novelty, price hike, additives.
Yeah.
Those three things are really saturating the market right now.
Well, so with mezcal, it's interesting because you don't find a lot of bottles in the $40 range.
Mm-mm, at all.
And when you do, oftentimes they are not what I would consider to be quality. Now, I understand the higher cost of some of the mezcals out there because they're using agaves that are not commercially farmed, that are hard to get to,
sure,
that are not as common in the place where they happen to be using them. There are a lot of things that pushes price up. But to go from $40 to $120 a bottle, there's a lot of money.
Bullshit in there.
Yeah, a lot of bullshit.
A lot of bullshit.
Yeah.
No, we did an episode on this, and I actually got into... I got into an argument with someone on the Facebook world, a guy named David Lozano. I probably shouldn't say his name. David Lozano. So we got in an argument.
Shout out to David.
Yeah, but I wasn't arguing as much as he was fucking yelling at me.
He is very passionate.
Yes. He's not a bad guy.
He's a super guy.
He's not a bad guy. He's a good guy. He's overly passionate and is, at times, I think, unreasonable. But he was one of the ones that just views me as the bourbon guy. And one of the things that has happened, and specifically in Mexican spirits, is the general rule of thumb, and I've beat this to death, so if anyone listening to this has heard me talk about it, feel free to skip ahead 5 minutes. But, you know, 30-35% markup margin somewhere in there is a pretty good rule of thumb at each tier. But I talked to a mezcalero who's selling his product to the States at like $19 a bottle, and it's on the shelf for like $70.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't track.
No, it doesn't make any sense at all.
And so I asked him. I went through his distribution tier. I know what retailers charge. And same thing like with the cognac. We imported the cognac ourselves. We mm-hmm. cut out an entire layer of cost. But importation's 10-15%, usually. Some higher. But what we were seeing is there was, you know, if I produce a product here in this a whiskey, Prideful Goat, whatever the shelf price is, if we sell it to a distributor for about half that, it's give or take pretty close.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not what's happening in Mexican spirits. We're seeing mezcaleros and soteleros sell their product at not half to the retail price, a fourth
mm-hmm.
of the retail price. Where's that money going? The money's going to, in some cases, the importer, the distributor. They're getting very wide, abnormally mm-hmm. large margins. But they're being marketed as, oh, the agave is hard to get. And like you just said, it's very, very old agave. It's, you know, 18 years old, some of these plants, 20 years old, some of these plants. I understand that. But to me, that feels like more of a crime. That feels more manipulative to the market than, say, a Rock or a Kendall Jenner tequila. A celebrity brand of tequila, it's easy to point the blame at someone.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to say that they're appropriating. But a lot of these Mexican producers will approach them because it's a two-way street. I get right. to sell 300,000 cases of tequila. Right. It happens all the time. To me, I feel like it's a much bigger crime. It's way more heinous. You can leave this part in. Way more heinous for us to be selling off the backs of these mezcaleros and soteleros as the third-generation families. Their whole life is this, the blah, blah, blah. But the money's not going to them.
Right.
And when we actually talked to some mezcaleros and soteleros about buying bulk liquid, we saw some liquid that is on the shelf, same exact liquid, for $150 a bottle. We could give them twice the amount at the supplier level, and we would be on the shelf at $80.
Mm-hmm.
So we could pay them double what they were paid for the liquid for this $150 brand,
right.
and we could be on the shelf at $80.
And you're still making a healthy margin.
And we're still
in the
making
industry,
it.
Yes. Yeah.
And so I feel when I see a quality $40 mezcal, it's fantastic. It's unheard of. But there's this big, large push between the distribution tier, going into bars, doing these tastings and trainings with their bartenders. They're pushing Mexican spirits are premium spirits. We need to respect them. They need to be 100. You know, we need to understand that they're worth $150. I understand that, but I don't disagree with you.
Yeah.
I think you can easily make an argument that a good quality 20-year-old plant, they have to go out and harvest it by hand. Okay, cool. I'm with you at $100 a bottle.
For some bottles.
For some bottles.
Not for the range of bottles that
are out
I think
there.
We see.
Yeah. But the money's not going back to them.
Right.
You're selling it off their back and then keeping the money, which to me is way more heinous. And I tried to explain that to David, and David was not having it. I'm just pointing out that I see it happening.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, what do you know? You're a bourbon Facebook guy. Okay.
So, right. you know, it's interesting. I think, and I'm going to qualify this first by saying, I know a lot of brand owners in every category of spirit who are absolutely fantastic, stand-up, honest, ethical, excellent people. But if you look at people who are specifically brand owners versus people who are also producers and importers of products like this,
sure.
I think that you'll probably see a difference in the way that pricing works. I feel like there are on the balance, more unscrupulous brand owners who could give a shit about the product, the producer, or anything along the way other than selling that product at a hyper jacked up price in the market here.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you, so one of my roles, one of the responsibilities I have, is presenting our products to large chain accounts across the country. If we go into a Liquor Barn or Big Daddy's has like 12 accounts in Florida, Specs has 200 accounts here in Texas, BevMo is in three states and they have like 500 accounts. One of the things, that conversation I've seen happen time and time again, no matter where you're at, is this is a popular brand that we have nothing to do with. Can you make a copy of that?
Mm-hmm.
Can you mimic this? Can you create something close to it?
And here's an even bigger issue for me. Whether it's a distributor or anybody else, people who are taking advantage of crossing the three tiers.
That doesn't bother me as much.
What bothers me about it is I try and do things right, which means when I see somebody else competing with me who is crossing tiers illegally, they're taking advantage of something that I'm not getting the advantage of because I'm trying to do it right.
But couldn't you take advantage of it if you wanted to? Can you give me an example? Because this is who I'm thinking of.
Well, yeah.
Morgan Weber. Morgan Weber owns a few bars through a trust, right? It's all legal on paper.
On paper.
On paper, it's all legal. But he also owns Marfa Spirits Company, a distillery out in Marfa, Texas that makes Atoll. He's transparent about it. He's honest about it. That doesn't bother me at all. Anyone who can gain this,
so
it's like taxes. Like Elon Musk pays no taxes. Hey man, I also try not to pay. I try to pay the least amount of tax I can, just like anyone else would.
Are you trying to buy Twitter too?
Yeah, no.
I was thinking more about a distributor or a retailer who is also owns and sells a brand of their own. But that's still a good example. And are there ways to game the system to meet the letter of the law while flouting the spirit of the law? Sure. But it still seems a little unfair to me.
Oh, it's definitely unfair because they have the money behind them.
Right. So that being said, I am all for, and I got in a big discussion with Dan Garrison about this years ago at a hearing at the Capitol on, I don't remember exactly what it was, but my position was that the state should change the law and require or allow at least a de minimis amount of crossover between the tiers.
Can you Google de minimis real quick?
Can you spell it?
Yeah. That feels like three words you said at once.
Well, so I don't know about all of this. I feel like most states will allow somebody to own up to usually 5 or 10% across tiers in those particular states. And, you know, in Texas, we have what they call the one share rule, where technically you cannot own one share of a business that is in a tier other than what your basic tier is, right?
Sure.
And I was advocating to change that and allow some amount of crossover. And
why?
Dan was, because if I own 10% of a restaurant, for example, and I own 100% of a distillery, is it realistic that I'm going to go into that restaurant and have any market power in pushing them to carry my products over other products? No, not at 10%.
But Papa's Brothers would be.
Well, if I own 51%, then sure, you would see my products in that bar to the exclusion of my competitors.
Right.
And that's what the whole purpose of the three-tier system is. Well,
sure.
It's a portion of what the purpose is about, right?
One of the things we've talked about in Texas is there's all this talk about Peter Luger's 100-year-old steakhouse in New York. But in Houston, like one of the number one click things you get on articles here is the openings and closures. Our turnover rate for restaurants and bars, there's no in fact, the most historical restaurants and bars in Houston are chains.
Mm-hmm.
It's Papa Brothers or what's the one, Gringo's, the Ibarra's. They're the only ones that have been able to make it work for decades. Everyone else is like in and out, in and out, in and out. So, yeah, I mean, if you were to change that rule, it would have a massive footprint in the market in regards to...
It would make a lot of people legal in terms of what their holdings are. I mean, technically in Texas...
You're saying it's already happening. They just need
to... Oh, yeah, it happens all the time. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And typically the way it happens is, you know, through a legal patchwork of different companies.
Like trusts?
Yeah, trusts or even just enough holding companies or whatnot in between that nobody's ever going to go that far back and check, right?
Sure.
So,
I mean, it would legitimize what's already happening, sure. It might turn the volume up a little bit. It might make it a little bit – it might exacerbate it a little bit. If it was fully legal, more people would try. I mean, I've had plenty of people – we know someone. Nico approached me about potentially working on a large chain volume for a specific restaurant group.
Mm-hmm.
It happens.
Well, and there's a lot of gray area there too, right? Because as a restaurant, you could – partner with a supplier to private label something for your restaurant.
Sure.
It's essentially the same thing.
Right. And that's exactly what it would be. I mean, you're essentially partnering.
Honestly, thinking, talking out loud, this really gets back to one of the things that I care most about in this industry that I think we talked about before, and that's transparency.
I mean, that same goes.
I hadn't thought about it in terms of this particular discussion, but as long as there's complete transparency, I'm okay with most things in this business.
I'm the opposite. It's like personal freedoms. I don't care if you want to do mushrooms in your apartment or acid on vacation. Like these things don't affect me. If they don't affect me, I don't care. And as a small producer, although technically I'm not a producer,
you're one of those brand owners that jacks their prices.
I'm one of the brand owners that manipulates the market. Yeah, right. That it's not. I think there's room because I think that the people who are manipulating the system fundamentally are creating inferior products.
Well, and let me be clear. I don't think.
Let's do. We got time for one more part. I want to do this. Right. What are these called?
They are copitas. They're from Oaxaca, and I thought it would be interesting because I had
better if it was a skeleton.
with a friend recently, we had some mezcal and some sotol, and we had each of them in glass and in these little earthen copitas.
Sure.
And we had each of them in these little earthen copitas and glass, and my experience was that with the mezcal, there was a pretty big difference in the taste between the glass and the copita. With the sotol, it was huge.
Huge difference.
And I'm sure it's not about mezcal and sotol. It's probably every product has a different sort of delta in between. But I thought it was an interesting way to start talking about palate and perception and all that sort of thing, because we're drinking the same thing out of a different vessel, and we're getting an entirely different experience from it.
Yeah, I think that applies to some things, and in other things, it's bullshit. For instance, a Miller Lite out of a red Solo cup at a baseball game is going to taste the same as in a fancy beer glass.
No doubt.
So again, it all comes back to what you're drinking and how that drink was made.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Brandon.
Do you think the same way with like aluminum bottles, though? Because I do feel like there's a little bit of a different taste experience.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because it tastes like aluminum.
Just making sure.
Well, meant fancy glass shapes. There's a lot of beer snobs out there that'll tell you, oh, you have to drink a stout glass versus that glass. Even if you talk to breweries and how they recarbonate certain products, the recarbonation isn't an exact science. It's largely a broad brush. It's kind of like, let's throw 1,000 milligrams of Tylenol at whatever you're feeling. It may be overkill, but it's gone. That's all that matters. That's how a lot of recarbonation is done. It's not an exact science. And when you go to open your beer and you let it sit there for 20 minutes, or if you open it and immediately hard pour it, gets all that head on it, it's still going to taste great after that head settles.
All right. I agree with you 100% on that, especially with the beer and the red Solo cups. And in fact, Just last night, I was with Mike G. He did a tasting of
Muscat Blind. Someone who gets tasting. Beat up a lot, too. I feel bad for him. He gave me a bottle of his Sotol. I've yet to open it.
I gave you a bottle, too, didn't I? Did you? Is it the same batch?
Actually, you gave me a small bottle. He gave me a half bottle.
That bastard.
I have them both.
So I look like I look bad
now. No. You gave it to me, and then I think he came to the social. He came to something and handed it to me, and I thought,
gave it to you out at Crowded Barrel when we were there for whatever that was
in Austin.
Yes,
that was when we were there for.
He was there that afternoon, but I didn't know he was going to be there.
I think maybe you gave it to me. Maybe he didn't give it to me, but it's his liquid.
We worked on that together.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there's a lot of story there. But anyway, so with him last night for this blind tasting, and we were tasting in those little, half-ounce plastic cups.
Ugh.
And I thought, this really is terrible. It's fine for going into specs and trying out something at the barrel on a Saturday evening.
Sure.
But it really just kills everything about the experience, about the aroma, about the taste, everything.
We ran a little long, and I'm going to leave it to Brandon to trim out all the trash talk we did.
Okay.
But let's have one more pour. You've not had one of my products.
I haven't.
No.
Actually, I think I had your very first rum.
Okay.
I think.
This was fantastic, by the way.
Thank you. You still, and we can do it after the fact, but I want you to taste that exact same thing in the glass.
Okay.
Like next to it, not like 3 days from now.
So, Jamaica rum. I actually found out that you wouldn't call it Jamaican rum.
Okay.
You would call it Jamaica rum, Barbados rum, not Baja rum, or Baja, whatever. You wouldn't say Barbadian rum. Barbados is the country, and then you would call it, I think, Baja?
Bahan?
Bahan. Yeah. Anyways, so 17-year-old Clarendon, we moved production facilities from Iron Root to Gulf Coast Distillers last year. 17-year, I don't believe, is available. Let me give you a little more. Cause
please.
It's a good mezcal in there. Dunder. So this is a funk bomb.
Right, let me ask you while you're telling me about it. Have you had the funk?
Sorry, have you had the funk?
I'm going to steal your glass.
Yeah. Okay.
What do you mean, have I had the funk?
It's a Jamaica pot still rum.
It's called the funk. Funk. Okay, yeah. I have not had it.
You probably, I don't know if you know Dave Schmier, but no. You know of him.
He's a big cream cheese fan, right?
Indeed he is. He's the guy behind Proof and Wood. He developed...
I feel really proud of that joke.
That is good. The president, the senator.
Yes.
The rye that he developed and sold off a few years ago.
He's got a long track record of. I mean, the senator and the what's the other one?
The president.
Presidential
dram and the Tumbling Dice.
He's got a long track record. Tumbling Dice
stuff.
Is great. Yeah.
He is one of the best at sourcing really cool shit and putting it in a bottle.
Sure.
That I know. But he has a rum, a pot still Jamaica rum.
Called the Funk.
And it is the highest ester, funkiest rum I've ever had in my life.
I will challenge.
It is crazy. And if I had known you hadn't had it, I would have brought a bottle with me.
I will challenge that. We've got this 27-year New Yarmouth that is 100% column still. This, the Clarendon, I believe, is if I remember correctly, is pot still at 136.8.
I dig it.
It is a funk bomb for sure. To go from the Waterford, the tempered, mild-mannered Clark Kent of drinks to the Jamaican Pauly Shore wild card Charlie Sheen funk, this is fantastic.
I dig it. So I know this is an unfair question.
Okay.
Is this your favorite of the gregarious?
Oh, no. No.
Or do you put them in order, or do you try and stay away from that?
I don't put it in order. I look back on the original releases differently than I did at the time that they were released. Meaning, I had originally liked the Belize and the Foursquare more. I like our current Belize and our 16-year Foursquare better than the 12-year we did and 14-year we did last time. So, yeah. In retrospect, my opinions have changed on a few of them, but this is not my favorite. I love this. It's funky for a different reason. This is month-long fermentation in an open vat, not Dunder style. So Cypress fermenters, month-long open fermentation. It's high ester, but it's not. It's high ester for a different reason than, say, the New Yarmouth, mm-hmm. which is Dunder style, funky funk, column still. This is pot still. And what I love about these things is that there's nothing like it in Texas.
No,
our independent bottlers or our independent bottlings are wholly unique to the southern part of the United States.
Yeah, this is really, really excellent. And I've had, I wouldn't say a lot, but I feel like recently I've had more than the average number of unfortunate rums.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I feel like rum is going through a slight renaissance. There's a lot of great, what's his name? Holmes Key.
Mm-hmm.
Eric Kay has produced some great independent bottlings of rum.
No, I don't get me. I think there's great rum. There's better rum out there than I've ever had in the last number of years.
Yes.
But I just in the last couple of months, I feel like I've had some mediocre rums. Yeah.
Care to name names since we're shit talking?
No. Separate and apart from all that, because I know we're out of time, you mentioned before we started that there was something you wanted to save until we started talking to my last trip to Houston. And I'm really curious as to what it was.
Oh, was that you convinced Golf Course to change its name?
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Gotcha. So I wanted to make it clear on camera that you kind of came in, you and Matt came in to kind of, I guess, field some business and work on some things, and you said some things that were kind of flippant mm-hmm. that actually made quite the impact.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to give you and Matt credit because Carlos respects you guys greatly, and you guys said some things that meant the world, that changed. And I say this with all sincerity. Carlos is a very busy, very wealthy man who is working on more companies than I think people realize.
Mm-hmm.
He's not just the coffee guy. He's not just Gulf Coast Distillers. The bandwidth is as hard as it is for me to remember people the night of the social. Carlos is times 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever you say something to him, even flippantly, that causes him to change how he does business, that is saying something.
Well, I appreciate that. I appreciate knowing it. And
it's harder than you realize.
Well, we've been around this, and you too. I mean, we've all been around this business for a long time, and we see things.
Sure.
And, you know, if there's anything I can do to provide something to somebody that might be helpful, I want to do it.
Sure.
Because I want everybody to be successful in this business, except for the people who are assholes and cheaters and, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, fuck those
bad
guys.
People.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But for people who are trying, for people who do good shit and are good people, and, you know, like, it's a complex, hard business. I don't know everything about it. I learn something new every fucking day, no matter how long I've been doing this. And sometimes people call me for advice about something. I'm like, why the fuck are you calling me? What do I know?
Sure.
But we all have experiences that we can share with other people about the, you know, particular things that we've learned along the way. And if we can do that, why wouldn't we?
That's exactly how it should be. No matter who you are or what realm you're in, if someone has a thought on something based off their own experience, listen to it. Take the information and then make a decision. But there are things, like, for instance, I'll give you a great example. There's a very large retailer that is known for, say, lower priced commodity products that wants to get into the premium space and is making great efforts to produce higher quality, higher priced items. And their perception of higher quality, higher priced items and my perception of higher quality, higher priced items are two different things. And one of the things I've learned is that my products, although they're the cheapest independent bottlings of those items, mm-hmm. they're still crazy expensive. Like some things, like our 27-year-old Jamaican, is $200. It's not scalable.
Yeah.
And so their perception of higher priced premium quality products are things that are still scalable. Mm-hmm. So I've had to learn and adjust. I wouldn't give this retailer any credit whatsoever up into this discussion, meaning I didn't respect because well, they produce shit, mm-hmm. right? And talking with them and taking in the information and taking in what sells and what's scalable and volume, like, okay, I need to produce still strict standards, still high quality, still premium, but maybe slightly younger, maybe mm-hmm. slightly lower price, something yeah. that can be scalable that is still premium, but not out of the price right. range of most people, especially during a pandemic or recession. So it's, I learned something. And there's always going to be the conversations I've had with you and Matt, the conversations I've had with Carlos. Like, I've learned a lot, and there's always more to learn. And then you end up learning something about a subject like mezcal or chatol that no one would necessarily give you credit for until, yeah. you know. So it's been interesting. I appreciate you coming on. I didn't expect to gossip with you so much.
No, I thought this was going to go down several different pathways than what it did.
No, like I said, we're friends. I've yeah. known you a long time. We tend to talk, and the way that we talk off camera is the yeah. way we talk on camera.
Well, so I'm going to go ahead and set this up for the okay. next interview. Which is, I don't know if you've ever had anybody on three times, but
I've had a few on seven times.
Well, I was fully expecting that because you liked that tweet I did yesterday.
What was it?
I was fully expecting for you to put me on the hot seat about the wine industry and.
Oh no! Yeah. I did see the tweet. So, but I didn't.
Let's save that for the next time. But
all right.
Yeah, I did call them out about their bullshit positions.
Okay, we'll save it for the next time.
All right.
Mark, thank you so much for coming on. I hope you still have your yeah. job at Susto after this.
Yeah, me too, for sure.
And that you guys didn't lose any distribution
yeah.
partners.
Yeah. We didn't call them out.
We didn't.
But, and you know who you are, and we love you.
Yeah. Mark, I love you, buddy. Thanks so much for coming on. I'll see you soon, buddy.